From an early age, we're all immersed in sport. For some, it fails to ignite a spark inside us, but for those of us who catch the fire, it's the beginning of a lifelong journey filled with highs and lows, which all matter far more than they should. After all, it's just a game, we're told. Sport is a certainty, it's a point of reference in an increasingly uncertain world, and the bonds formed with either sport in general or a hometown club transcend both time and generations. Today, much of what sport has always meant to true fans has been somehow lost in a blizzard of corporate communications, fireworks, and froth. The attachments that were once so strong seem more trivial in the global age of televised sport as entertainment. What was once authentic has become increasingly staged. In this podcast, we'll get back to the things that sport has always meant to true fans. We'll take you from the boardroom, to the dressing room, to the pitch, but we'll do it not as a corporate communication, but as true fans of sport, and we'll do it with authenticity. We'll be honest, and we'll speak our minds. This is a podcast for true sports fans, and the one thing all fans have in common is a passion for the game. Now, we certainly don't mean to cause any offence, so if you find yourself taking any, just shrug it off and get back in the game, because this is about the game, and the game is bigger than all of us. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? As we approach Christmas, there's still plenty of sport, as is always the case this time of year, and we have a fantastic guest coming up to discuss several sports in which he's been a high-level executive. But before that, I want to welcome my two co-hosts to the show. Roger Mitchell, where are you, Rog? Come in.
Hi there, I'm in Como in the middle of a storm, and hopefully this doesn't ruin the connectivity, but I fear the worst, my friend.
Well, we shall see. The good news is we always know when you're around. And also, Giles, where are you? Are you in London still?
Yeah, I'm just in Wandsworth. Nothing changes. Haven't been let out, so that's me.
Well, boys, it's been another fascinating week in sport, and I guess the thing we have to talk about quickly before we get to our guest is... Roger, and I'm going to go to you on this, is this amazing Italian kick-out racism campaign.
Oh God, I'm not prepared for this.
Well, I'm sorry, but this is right in your wheelhouse. Yes,
right, exactly. Okay.
This is right in your wheelhouse. I mean, what on earth?
Right. Okay, well, I mentioned in the last podcast, let me do this the way that I think needs to be said. Italian football is full of very high-powered overseas executives who come out here and fail dramatically. Michael Bolingbroke, Cazidis is having a dreadful time. And why is that? It's because they don't get Italy. Now, the thing with Italy is this. If you look at an Italian newspaper, you will get to page 9 and you will still get news that will knock your socks off. You know, like acrobat thief breaks into male house and kidnaps the daughter. You know, like page 9 type thing. So the point I'm making is this. For people outside Italy, don't get the fact that it's still the Borgias here. It absolutely still is. And when they do something like this, like they did with Black Friday, and then they I can tell you they're a little bit surprised at the reaction from overseas, because they just don't get it, you know? And you know, and then it's the whole Catholic thing. You do something, it's bad, you move on, people forgive you, you move on. The reality is that Italian football hasn't got its head around racism yet, and it hasn't got its head around guilt. And that's the best I can do for you, Grant.
Well, that's actually far more level-headed than I was expecting from you, Rog. I mean, I know we had this conversation last week, and what you explained to me actually helped me look at it in a slightly different way than I would have done without that conversation. But I'm still left scratching my head as to how you can be just so utterly oblivious in this day and age. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Well, let me tell you another thing. You know, most of the worlds that we live in are meritocracies regarding suppliers, RFQs, RFPs, RFIs, all that. There's a process. In Italy, most of these things, and a lot of people in work, are friends of friends, friends of politicians, lovers of somebody else, etc., etc., etc. So what happens is that there's nobody around that's of quality, often, certainly in Serie A, this is the case, that says, are you smoking dope? There's nobody around. And even if they think that it is a mistake, they're too scared because the system still is absolutely futile.
Well, that's fair enough, I guess. I dare say we will be talking about this later.
Yeah, but I have to say this growth of meritocracy is playing havoc with my career. I mean, the moment you need talent, that's me out of nearly every job. So I'm moving to Italy. Have you got room, Rog?
Oh, for you, absolutely. We discussed that the other night there, Giles. It's a good market here.
I think it's got my name written all over it.
Well, look, something else that's got your name written all over it, Giles, is our guest this week, who's a good friend of yours.
So our guest this week is a bit of a Christmas treat, actually. He's a good friend of mine and someone who's been in the sports industry pretty much since it was invented. Ian Ritchie, who has a litany of achievements, former chief executive officer of the All England Tennis Club, CEO of the Rugby Football Union during the 2015 Rugby World Cup, and more recently he's been chairman of Premiership Rugby and involved in so many facets of sport in the UK and around the world. And it is a real joy to have you on Are You Not Entertained? Hello, Ian.
Charles, my pleasure. Always good to talk about sport.
Well, quite. It's all we ever talk about, which is good. And it's great that we have Roger and Grant with us because they really like just sort of jabbering on. So I think they've got a million questions for you.
We certainly
nice
do.
Nice to see you, Ian. Lovely for you to come on.
And I think as well, as ever, appreciate the mention of 2015 and the World Cup and with your Welsh antecedents. So not that I would ever forget it.
Do you know what? It's funny. When we met recently and you mentioned that another individual never let you forget it, you just put it into my mind. So I'm not going to let you forget it either.
I'm twitching.
Sorry. Anyway, what have you been up to recently? Well, in fact, I know that you went to sort of, you thought the rugby world might be a quieter pasture. And I think the last 2 years you've been really quite busy as rugby completely redefines itself.
Well, I think it's, you know, when you have a love of something and then you get opportunities to work in it and be involved in it, it's very difficult to not to continue that involvement. So although I allegedly retired a couple of years ago from the RFU, when you have an opportunity within rugby or indeed in other sports to continue, however occasionally challenging it can be, you don't want to miss that opportunity. And as I say, I consistently feel like a bit of a schoolboy. You know, if anybody said to me when I was 16 or 18 that you'd have the opportunity to work in sport, I frankly wouldn't have believed it at the time. So therefore, as I say, even in retirement, although some of the key phrases now are I am non-executive, I think it says in front of all the things that I do. And
that,
therefore,
that just means, Ian, you don't get paid for it. It just means you don't get paid for it.
You're doing it for the love. Speaking as a Scotsman brought up in Yorkshire, of course, money is of no importance to me whatsoever.
Ian, you talk about the 15, 16 year old self. Can you take us back there? And just I'm always interested in people's kind of sporting roots. You know, I presume you had a love of rugby at that age. Was that your only sport, or were you a tennis player back then? Were you a footballer? Because it's tough to be in Yorkshire and not play cricket. So, what were your early sporting days like?
Well, I think everything to do with a ball. I mean, at school, we played rugby and cricket. I started to play tennis a little bit later on. And of course, you know, being brought up in the early 60s in Leeds, you became an obsessive Leeds United supporter. And indeed, my father, when he moved down from Scotland, he actually took a job as working for the then chairman of Leeds United. And so, you know, he got a couple of season tickets as part of his job. So he started taking me to Elland Road, and it was absolutely the time that Don Revy started getting involved. And then, of course, you became obsessed. So watching was heavily involving Leeds United. Playing was a chunk of rugby. There was a mix over as well, because Don Reavy's son Duncan was in my sort of in my school, and in fact we were the front row of the under 13 Leeds Grammar School rugby team. And we used to travel to the rugby games, you know, used to play most of them on a Saturday, obsessing about what was happening with Leeds United. So it was a very powerful front row at the time. But so I think, you know, brought up, both my parents were very sporty, you know, all my family did. So anything, I've never been very good. You could say I've never been very good at any of the sports, but usually they've got to involve a ball. Sitting down, cycling, running, swimming, skiing, none of those sort of things, not ergonomically designed for those, but anything to do with a ball. And yeah, early days as well. I remember going to Headingley to watch an England test match, and I remember watching Freddie Truman, it then was, I think it was 1964, running in from the boundary rope. And a thing of beauty it was, Freddie Truman's run-up. But yes, so there was Yorkshire Cricket, Leeds United, watching and playing a bit of rugby as well, and golf too. So anything to do with the ball was extremely keen on.
That Leeds United team, well, I mean, what a perfect time to become a Leeds United supporter, at an age as well where I guess you're so impressionable. What was it like being a Leeds fan? Because that team was such a polarizing team. I mean, everybody else hated them. And I mean, everybody. They didn't have any friends outside the confines of the city limits, I would imagine. So what was it like being a fan of that particular team?
Well, I think you became almost obsessive. I mean, because it was such a fantastic experience to go to Elland Road. And yeah, I think like a lot of things, yes, they weren't the most popular team, but I mean, so therefore your love of Norman Hunter became even stronger when everybody else hated him, and you know, Billy Bremner, Johnny Giles, etc. And of course, and then you had, although we won quite a few things, I mean, I was lucky enough to go, you know, I was at Wembley in 69 when we won the League Cup, which I think was the first thing we won, and then in 72 when we beat Arsenal in the FA Cup. Yeah. But then again, we came second a lot of times, and therefore you always had this as well feeling of we was robbed. I mean, you know, I can still see it now. I think it was 1971. There was a match against West Bromwich at Elland Road, and we needed to win. And Ray Tinkler was the referee, and I can see it. Not that it's etched in my memory at all, just to be clear. And West Brom had a goal that was palpably offside, and you need to look at the pitches sometimes. There was a load of elderly men ran onto the pitch. I mean, they weren't sort of, you know, there was people in suits. I can see them now running onto the pitch to remonstrate, and we lost that. And then even when we beat Arsenal in 72, we had the chance of doing the double, and we played Wolverhampton away on Monday night after the cup final. And we lost that as well, and yet we played 2 days after the cup final, and so there was the immortal everybody's a Guinness, but it was obsessive, absolutely obsessive, and the great thing was, I think it's true about a lot of sport, isn't it? It takes you out of yourself, it really does, and there's numerous examples I'm sure we can all give of whether it's watching teams, supporting teams, and again, you know, even more recently for me, involved in rugby in various World Cups and that sort of thing, is the great beauty is sport really does take you out of yourself. And then in those early days with Lee, and of course, I'm still now, you know, I always love that phrase as well. It's the hope that kills you. So Leeds now, you perennially hope, are going to get promoted again. I mean, I'm again equally not recovered from watching us lose to Derby in the playoffs last season. So having been one up from the first leg. So I think, you know, my wife constantly says to me, why do you take it so seriously? And I say, well, yeah, because you do.
She's got to go, Ian. She's got to go, I'm afraid.
She's got to go. I'm sorry. 39 years married to a Yorkshire solicitor. I'm afraid I'm stuck with it.
And when did you decide, you know, obviously you were a fanatical sports player and fan. When was the moment you decided you wanted to work in the sports industry? I know you had a long, illustrious career in media and television as well. Did you ever think that you were going to get involved in the sports industry, or did it happen by accident? Was it something that you had been secretly plotting? Given that what you've now ended up doing over the last 10, 15 years, involved in so many of the sports, particularly in the UK, do you think it was an itch you wanted to scratch, or did it just happen by chance?
No, I'd love to say it was planned. I'm sure, like most of us, you can't really plan these sort of things. So, when I was working in television, obviously, I was lucky enough, you know, when I first started working at Granada in Manchester, I mean, you know, I remember them saying to me, well, you better go out and see how we make a TV programme. And so the two things they sent me on was go to Castle Howard and watch Brideshead Revisited being made, which was quite a challenge and interesting. And the second bit was, there's an outside broadcast at Anfield in the European Cup. You better go and see that. So you had an involvement with sport. I mean, the first job I actually got was I became an INED at West Ham United. And that was because, in fact, I was a headhunter at the time, and I was doing the work for the then chairman. And he knew I'd worked in media and television. And I rang him up to say, I'm leaving the headhunter, I'm going back into the media. And he said, well, and I said, so-and-so is now handling this search for your non-executive director. And he said, don't bother with that. Why don't you do it? So I spent several years at West Ham on the board there in an era when they had, you know, I mean, it was Rio Ferdinand, Frank Lampard, Paolo Di Canio. I mean, they had a fantastic team, really. Although I always remember, and I said to Terry Brown, the then chairman, I said, well, you know, you've got to understand, you know, I'm a Leeds United supporter. He said, yeah, I get that. You're here to help us with various things. And Leeds came the first game when I was on the board, and I was saying beforehand, I'm hoping for a nice, restful 0-0 draw. And it ended up, I think it was 5-1 to Leeds, and Ian Wright got sent off playing for West Ham, and it was you know, very difficult stuff, but they were very good about it. So I got involved with West Ham, and then that led to me, after that, I then got involved, because I'd been involved with West Ham, I got involved on the Football League Board. So the start off was all in football. I did 8 years on the Football League Board.
And how did the All England club come about? I mean, to work for, I would always argue, and others I'm sure disagree, but I think on the global stage, the All England, Wimbledon, obviously, as we all know, the All England club and the championships has to be one of our greatest sporting exports globally. I can't think of many that are any bigger. How did that happen, and what did it feel like to be in the sort
I was working then for the Associated Press for the American News Agency, and in those days, even then, it was, you know, you read the appointments pages of the Sunday Times, and there was an advert for the chief executive of the All England Club, and I thought, oh, that looks quite interesting, and I thought, maybe I don't hit the spec, maybe I do. And I remember, you know, my wife said, well, you know, what's the harm? Why don't you just stick in an application and see what happens? And then they offered me the job. So it came about through that. And I went along, did a series of interviews. Again, hopefully the media connections, I'd done various sort of events, if you like, and stuff, not on the same scale as Wimbledon, but you know, when I'd been involved in various things within television. And so it came about. And my predecessor, a lovely man, Chris Gorringe, had been doing the job for, what, nearly 30 years. They obviously, you know, were looking to things develop and change as they would do. And therefore, they offered me the job. And what a joy it was. I mean, it is one of those things where you think it's a privilege to be there. And of course, the difficulty is, you know, when I arrived, I mean, I think Wimbledon was, somebody said to me once that it's always very difficult if you're sitting on top of a pyramid, because there's only one way to go, and it's painful. And, you know, Wimbledon, I think, has been sitting on top of a pyramid for a long time, due to all the team and the committee and the members and everything that makes it work. So your major thing is, you know, don't drop the ball, don't fall off the top of the pyramid. But what a joy it was to deal with that. And the great beauty, one thing people used to say to me, well, is it different between governance jobs with governing bodies or clubs? And of course, the great beauty is that at least then you're not worried who wins. You may have private favourites or whatever, but the fact of the matter is, it's all about the event, and who wins the event is therefore academic, you're allowed to be neutral. Whereas the great difficulty I speak with feeling when you move into something like the RFU or indeed into football clubs is of course you're judged whether you're winning or not. And that's the big difference, really. So Wimbledon was a joy and enjoyed it hugely.
Ian, you mentioned there being a headhunter, and all the times I've followed your career, you've always made a big thing, rightly so, about choosing the right people in recruitment. One of the things I always do, and maybe this is silly, but I think it always works, is that when I'm looking to hire people, I always ask them what their favorite player in their team was. So because it gives you away their character. So if we go back to that Leeds United team, and obviously you went from Billy Bremner to Last Waltz Eddie Gray, who would your favorite player have been?
My favorite was actually Mick Jones. Somehow, because I just sort of empathized with him a lot more, and he didn't get some of the, you know, Eddie Gray was obviously a great player, and Billy Bremner, Johnny Giles, all of that lot, but Mick Jones was my favorite, and I suppose as well because, you know, he always used to work his socks off, and it was really important that he did that sort of thing, and he was, I think, also very much a team player. He did his bit for the team. But I think you're right as well. I think what do you do when you're in any sort of senior management position? It is the usual classic as well. Of course, you always want to appoint people who are better than you, because it then reflects well on you. But the two things, I think, in terms of caliber of people to recruit and also people that, and I'm sure you would feel the same, you've got to have fun working with people. So they've got to be a decent fit. Because if you That's can't right. have a bit of a sense of humour about it, even if it's serious, there are all moments we all know where it's serious, where it's challenging, where it's painful, etc. And the thing that sustains throughout most of that is then working with people who are hopefully supportive in a team environment and also that you enjoy working with and have a sense of humour. So I think those are the most important things.
So let me press you again on that, again, pour parler, because we're football fans. So Don Revie creates this wonderful team of all different types of personalities, but it's a well-oiled machine. So you, with all your experience then and certainly now, how would you have handled the arrival of Brian Clough and those 44 days?
Sighed like a true Leeds fan.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, it's a bit like anything. It's now, of course, epitomised in the damned United. So you sit yeah. back and having watched that film several times as to what was it like. So it's funny enough. It's back to the how do you change? And I suppose I've always been more evolutionary than revolutionary when it comes to change. I suppose that's the nature of the beast that I am. And therefore, how far is an organization ready for a bomb to be dropped into the middle of it? And or how far are you prepared to then just say, well, no, we need to make some changes, but you do it in a slightly more understated, quieter fashion. So I suppose Brian Clough had persuaded himself that he was going to make a big change. And presumably the board knew that when they appointed him. And yet clearly, whether or not the players and the culture of the organization was ready for that, ultimately proved not to be the case. And as I say, I think, you know, my general sort of management philosophy is more, I'm all in two things. I think I'm all in favor of making change, absolutely. Maybe we'll come back and talk about changes at Wimbledon over the piece as well. But how do you make them and how do you engage with everybody and how do you make sure you take everybody with you? I think if you're into a dictatorial, this is what I think and this is what I'm going to do, and you don't engage with everybody around you and bring it in, and it's that, I hate the phrase to a degree, but I mean, if you're working in what they call multiple stakeholder environments, then somehow or other you can't operate if you don't bring those people along with you. And I suppose that's generally my view of life. So do I want to win? Is it right to make change? Absolutely. How do you do it? and how do you achieve it in the best possible way? Sometimes you've got to be a little bit more diplomatic and politic about it.
Ian, you kind of preempted my question a little bit there, because I wanted to bring us back to tennis as you were talking about change and the All England Club, because that's something which is such a venerable institution. And I think from the outside, from the fans' perspective, we kind of see, it feels like Wimbledon is presented almost as a moment in time, and it seems like the executives behind the scenes try and make it look like nothing's changing. And yet behind the scenes, I'm sure you have to keep up this constant evolution of sport, whether it be in digital rights or digital media or TV coverage.
Yeah.
How do you manage that tricky balance in keeping something with so much tradition looking almost unaltered on the outside, but keeping up with the times behind it?
Yes, and I think it's a really good point, and I think it's highly pertinent, because Wimbledon clearly takes all those elements of tradition, you know, tennis in an English country garden, you know, flowers all over the place, etc. And yet, if you're a brand, dare I call it a brand, if you leave that in the 1920s, then you're not going to operate too well in the 21st century. So what Wimbledon, I think, and again, this is part of the team and the whole committee and thing, has been to sort of say, well, how are we going to modernize? I mean, my sort of favorite example, well, I've got two, if I may, two sort of favorite examples. One, the introduction of Hawkeye. I mean, I remember thinking at the time, well, this is going to be interesting, because we had to change the scoreboards that had been there for years, put up a sort of video screen, introduce Hawkeye. And as you know well, if you're working in a sporting environment, the public have a view. And I'm thinking, wow, we're going to get loads of notes about this. And not a single complaint or note. And I think Hawkeye, the way in which it was introduced more generally in tennis, I think was successful. And therefore, it was almost immediately accepted. And in the same way that other things about digital, and I mean, I know Wimbledon, again, nothing to do with me, because it was only last year, I think, was voted Digital Brand of the Year. Now, if you'd said in the 1920s, obviously, that was Wimbledon going to be Digital Brand of the Year, you wouldn't have thought so. But they've done a fantastic amount on digital, on how does it work across the world, how does it work with different demographics. And I mean, it's a bit like the funny thing. It's kept that traditional thing. But I think it was 1968. Wimbledon was the first ever open tennis tournament. You know, it was the first one to do away with, you know, amateurs and professionals and have the first open Grand Slam in 1968. The debenture scheme they introduced that funds a lot of the building work was introduced in 1928, I think it was. So they've always had sort of bright ideas and good things to do, and so have modernized. And obviously, and the biggest thing, obviously, when I was there was we put a small matter of a roof on the center court. And then, of course, brilliantly, the sun shone for 3 years and we never used it.
The question I had, sorry to interrupt, is one of the things, and you talked about it earlier in terms of the management, is that I think, as Grant mentions, that the general public, the people who are lucky enough to go to the All England, you know, and see the championship over the fortnight, they see this perfection, it's effortless, and obviously there's a lot of scurrying around behind the scenes to make it so. But the other thing is, it's the Lawn Tennis Association runs the game of tennis in the United Kingdom. You then have the other three Grand Slams. You then got the professional tours of the men and the women's game. So like every sport, particularly international sport, there's an awful lot of blazers, an awful lot of stakeholders, and an awful lot of people who need to be appeased. And the All England sit in a privileged position. How did you, when you started the role, I'm intrigued to know how you felt you were going to manage that stakeholder of all of that sort of assortment, which you wouldn't make up if you were inventing tennis today, but is what the game has been presented with.
No, you wouldn't. But I mean, the two or three things just on your point, Giles. I mean, I think that being a tennis, I mean, my usual trite phrase has been, you know, the All England Club is a tennis club that has a bit of a do in the summer. And the bit of a do is, the beauty of it is, obviously, it's in the same place all the time, one. Two, I think the focus that being a tennis club and a members club gives it is, you know, you have nothing else to concentrate on. You know, if you're if you're at the RFU or the FA or any other sports, you've got participation, you're worrying about this, you're worrying about that. There's many more facets, if you like. Whereas the great beauty of the All England Club is, being a tennis club that has a tournament in the summer, it gives it a heck of a lot of focus in order to get it right. And a single-mindedness and comparatively speaking, a lack of interference. In other words, whether it be from governments or from other outside sources, the club has an ability pretty much to do what it wants to do. And that focus, and I think that long-term planning as well. A lot of businesses, we all know, have short and medium-term pressures, whereas the All England Club rightly has a long-term view of life and invests accordingly, whether it's the facilities or the resources or the grounds or its view of life, which I think is terribly helpful. So I think that single-minded nature is very good. And of course, I don't think it's an accident that probably the only other sporting environment that's similar to that is Augusta. And you know, if Wimbledon tennis is synonymous, then Augusta and the Masters is the same. And of course, they've got the same sort of philosophy that here's a club that has this tournament and they can focus on it accordingly. So I think it's the single-mindedness that really works very well. And I think,
you talked about Augusta. I mean, I understood that it's often reported that in the media that the All England and Augusta have a very strong relationship. Is that true? Do they talk? Are they cousins from across the Atlantic where they compare notes, or is that a media fancy?
No, there is. I think there is a genuine associate. Because again, and look, I think this is true of most sports wanting to talk to other sports. You can always learn things from each other. And I mean, yeah, I can happily say when I was here at Wimbledon as the chief executive, you know, Billy Payne, then the chairman of the Masters, came and I took him around the grounds and there were loads of things. And similarly, when one's been lucky enough to go to Augusta, you always learn things and cross-fertilise on ideas. And I think there is a great empathy between the two of them. And as I say, you can always learn stuff. So, yes, that's there. And I think, I believe, obviously not involved now, but I believe to this day it's still pretty strong.
I've been lucky enough to go to Augusta, and I've been lucky enough to go to Wimbledon as well. And one of the things that both seem to do is that they spend a lot of time, particularly in the last few years, really focusing on the fan and the spectator experience. If you go to Augusta, you have the cheapest sandwiches and it's all subsidized and you sit in these heavenly sort of lawns looking at extraordinary golf. But the fan is front and center. And I think those lucky enough to go to All England see the same. It is the ultimate fan experience. Is that something that you,
I think it is,
in that role, I think spent a lot of time?
I think that's right. I think the other thing is the two elements I would say in equal measure are obviously the players. You know, I think that, you know, the two double whammies, or if you like, the double whammies you try and go for is you want your event to be the one the players want to win most, and therefore you want to treat them as being special, and that absolutely applies to the spectator. I think always conscious, certainly at Wimbledon, how difficult it is to get a ticket. So therefore, if somebody does get a ticket and manages to come, you want it to be a special experience and to exceed their expectations. And a little bit back to the philosophy about the club, I always remember, I think, funny, if it was even true this year, I think Ms. Hallett said, when she won, she first thing she almost said was, "Oh, I'm now a member." Yeah. You know, and she wasn't interested necessarily about the trophy or the money or everything else. She's, "I'm now a member of the All England Club." And I remember watching Novak Djokovic the first time he won, and I think he got off a plane in Belgrade, and he's wearing his All England Club member's tie. And you sort of think, well, that's almost symptomatic of you want it to be seen to be special. And that's the special bit in the same way as the green jacket is at Augusta. There's something additional to just winning money, winning a fantastic event. There is a part of history. There is a connectivity with the club. And I think, you know, the players recognize that. And therefore, I think that's true every time somebody is lucky enough to come to the event as well.
Ian, I have to do this. I'm going to put my fan hat on.
because I'm fascinated. You know, for me, Roger Federer is arguably the greatest athlete of his generation. When you rep talent, dedication, hard work, flair, and just his persona, his charisma, and the way he treats, you know, both opponents and fans. I'd love to know, as an unabashed fan, where does Federer stand, both in the pantheon of the game and amongst the modern era, with in the eyes of the executives? Because you get to see not just the man on the court, but the man behind the court. And I'm just fascinated as to the view of Federer from people who aren't just fans, but also have to deal with him on a day-to-day basis.
Well, I think he's just an amazing ambassador, for the sport, and also has always been an amazing ambassador for Wimbledon as well. I mean, I know he loves coming to Wimbledon. I know he thoroughly enjoys himself when he does, and he's always prepared to go the extra mile to help. Now, I will say this: in my experience, I think he is fantastic and exceptional. I've always found the other players as well, or the players that come to Wimbledon have been pretty much the same. They enjoy the experience, they recognize how special it is, and certainly every time in my experience when I ask somebody to do something, either with helping coaching kids in training practice week or doing something outside, they have been a joy to deal with. And if I may, I will. I'll say the same about the England rugby players that I've been lucky enough to be involved with. They too, I think, have been a joy to deal with. And I think they really get how important their role is to inspire children, to inspire the part of the game, and yet they're obviously very rightly obsessed with what's their own performance and what do they need to do that. But I think they all get that wider perspective, and I think I can only talk about the two that I've been most directly involved with, tennis and rugby, is that they really do get that.
I was wondering that. I mean, you weren't the chief executive during the 80s when there was a certain McEnroe around, did you? And perhaps you're far too well. I know you're far too professional, but you might not let on. But did you ever have any of the? Because I've got plenty in golf I could talk about of people who didn't necessarily play it quite right during the Wimbledon time, where they perhaps threw their toys out of the proverbial pram.
I think the interesting thing, going back to the Hawkeye scenario. I mean, of course, John McEnroe would have not have been able to do what he did had Hawkeye been introduced then, because as somebody once famously said to me, Hawkeye is objectively wrong if it's wrong. You can't argue with it. So you could have a debate with an umpire about, how can you possibly call it that way? But it's pretty difficult to do stuff with Hawkeye. I think one's got to understand, again, having seen it fairly close to over a few years, the commitment and effort that elite players have to put in, I think, is astonishing. I mean, I really do take my hat off to them. And tennis players being a particular example, to live out of a suitcase for 40-odd weeks of the year, because, of course, the tour, the slams, they all go around the world. And so, at least if you're a rugby or a football player, you get half of your games at home, usually. Tennis players are all over the place all of the time. But I think it's understandable that there are pressures, and how do you release them and how do you deal with it? So I think, and also you've got to understand that some of these players, tennis players as well, I mean, well, as recent now as could be 15 or 16. So therefore they don't sort of behave all the time.
Well, I'll tell you a funny story, and I won't mention the name of the person because he'll come around and slot me. But on a particular golf tournament in China, we had a situation where one of the world's very top players lost his rag because someone hit the waiter had taken away his lunch before he'd finished with it. So he went off on one, and that was sort of calmed down, and it was tricky. But whilst he was going off on one, someone had nicked his driver from his golf bag. So he then went outside outside, having finished his lunch, which he had to have a second plate, and actually discovered his driver had been stolen. Oh my God. I genuinely thought that China was gonna grind to a halt as this person. I have never heard language like that since I played rugby up in Newcastle.
You must get out more. No, the worst conversation was certainly at Wimbledon, was, of course, after the final. So you know, you're one of the first people to wander up to the chair of the players to sort of say, and obviously for the winner, it's unalloyed joy, different planet, fantastic. For the loser, you know, you've then got to find some phraseology, you know, the immortal, you know, what do you say, better luck next time, or hard cheese, or all of this sort of thing. And I found that the most difficult bit to do was, what do you say to a person whose life ambition is to get to a Wimbledon final and then loses. And there is the man in the blazer coming up to him to utter a few words and to say, by the way, you may be completely shattered, but you've now got to be interviewed by Sue Barker. Please walk this way. I think when you see it that close, you've got to give them a heck of an amount of credit. You know, either immediately you walk off the court or you've just lost the most important match of your life, and there you go. You've got to walk 20 yards down the centre court to be interviewed by Sue Barker in front of millions of people. And to deal with that, I think, and they all do deal with it, is to their immense credit. It really is.
Let's come back to, again, football and the really difficult introduction of VAR, which I think... Honestly, this from my point of view, this was a disaster waiting to happen, because I had seen it introduced in Italy 2 years earlier, and all the things you've seen in England this year have happened here. So why does football not manage to organise this the way that rugby does, with the referee and the replay, Hawkeye, even cricket? What is the problem with VAR?
Well, it's always difficult when you, I mean, again, back to your point about it's back to the planning and the thinking in advance. I mean, Hawkeye, which I certainly don't claim credit, I think it actually came from the US, about limiting the number of challenges, which of course is fairly artificial, to say the least. You know, so the idea that you can only have a given number of challenges, and indeed, I think therefore the introduction of Hawkeye in most cases showed how good the officials are, because, you know, when you see the infinite distance, the finite, very small distance that exists between in or out, then you can understand how difficult it is. So I think it's how you bring it in and how you deal with it. I think, again, if I may, certainly just by one of the major differences between rugby and football is the crowd see it all and hear it all. So rugby union referees are mic'd up, so you can hear them all the time. As you know well, and we've all been to matches, you sit there with RefLink and you can listen to Wayne Barnes all through the match. And you know what he's doing. And if you watch and listen to Wayne Barnes, what I've always liked is he's running along and he's not even stopping play, and he's got the TMO in his ear telling him what he thinks, or Wayne is saying, what about this? And Wayne doesn't always stop it for the TMO. He'll make a thing. So I think the two or three things is, to me, you've still got to be clear that the referee is in ultimate control, and this is an aid to the referee. And I think the other thing that's helpful with rugby union is that the engagement to the crowd, a bit like with Hawkeye as well, is they see it all in front of them. So they know what's happening, they see what's happening, and indeed in the right way, it actually adds to the entertainment value, because they can see it. So I think the you know, one of the prima facie things is to make sure that it's explained to everybody and everybody understands it, and they actually see it. I mean, most football clubs, I mean, at rugby, as you know, at internationals anyway, you see everything on a big screen. And indeed, you are watching it sometimes with the referee. And then you're also listening to the debate between the referee and the TMO very publicly. And I think that's a hugely positive thing to do. If you do it in secret, if you like, or people can't listen to it, then there's always a what's happening, what's going on. So I think that's the major difference.
Well, let me be provocative, which is my want, really, and ask you something a little bit more that maybe will take us into the world of sponsorship. Would it be fair or unfair to say that it's because the quality of fan that follows football is perhaps not as tolerant as the quality of fans of the other sports I mentioned?
No, I don't think that. I think the great beauty, I speak with feeling, having been a very and continuing probably one-eyed Leeds United supporter, you know, would VAR have made that West Brom man offside in 1971? You know, I really don't know, but I'd probably still have the same opinion. I think the thing is that you always have to engage with the fan. It's going back to what Giles was saying about what hopefully you try and do at Wimbledon, what we try and do anywhere else, what we used to try and do as well at Twickenham, is you want to engage with the fan. You want them to know what's going on. You want them to be informed. You want them to understand it. And I think the great beauty of sport is every fan, and sometimes you can watch the same incident three or four times and either have a different view to another fan or indeed change your view as it goes. Because sometimes these things, you know, an offside on VAR, is that man's elbow really making him offside or not? You might take a general view that said it doesn't really, but if you were watching that as one fan, you'd have a view and another one. So no, I think the great beauty of sport is engagement and involvement, and that's what we all need to strive to do even more and not do less of it. And I don't think it makes a difference. To me, if you're a fan, you're a fan, and there's all different sorts of types of fan, and they all have different opinions. And that, again, is the beauty of it. I mean, the great beauty about standing in, whether it's a pub or a coffee house or whatever, and having a debate about it, is what makes sport so enthralling.
It is. It's interesting what you say that about Hawkeye. I think one of the great genius bits of Hawkeye when it was introduced in tennis is it's now become part of the tennis experience. As you say, the fan is as excited about the decision, and it becomes a thing. And it's interesting you talk about rugby and football, obviously with RefLink, and it seems that the fan is better engaged to understand what's going on, and therefore the polemic decision is made. Making it in secret probably doesn't help. I'm interested as well, Ian, again, you've worked in, you know, Twickenham is one of the great stadia of the UK, and Wimbledon is obviously Wimbledon. How much time with your executive teams did you spend on looking after the fans? I would imagine a lot in terms of trying to give them the best experience, whether it be in-home, at stadium, in the car parks, stations, entrance, exits. I mean, was that something that you were very conscious of, that in order to keep the product, and I use the word advisedly, as attractive as possible to keep people coming back for more?
Yeah, I think you've got to. And sometimes it's very difficult. I mean, you know, I would say when I was at Twickenham, some of the biggest problems you used to have were about drinking and toilets and people getting up in the middle of the game to go and, you know, so how do you trade off the fact that, you know, the bars are open and people are having a drink, and yet somebody sat down to watch a match and they have to get up and down all the time to go to the loo? How far do you deal with that overall fan experience? I mean, one of the things we tried very much on the 2015 World Cup, forgetting the Welsh game, of course, but as a matter of generality, I think was a great spectator experience. I think most people thoroughly enjoyed all the games. You know, the atmosphere was fantastic. I mean, you know, again, you go back to the sort of Japan-South Africa game in Brighton. And also what they did at Brighton as well was the entertainment outside the ground. I mean, it helped. It was in decent weather and the sun was shining. But the whole fan experience, I think anybody who was at that game thought, you know, what a fantastic content. But the whole atmosphere, the way the whole South African supporters liaised with the Japanese, I think that. So I think you're absolutely right. You're very conscious nowadays, when there are so many competing things to go and see and do, that if you're putting on an event, you've got to make it as good as possible. But, of course, there are things you still can't deal with. You know, how much time does it spend to get there? How are the transport situations? What's happening with queues? How do you deal with that? And again, some of the stadium, obviously, are older than others. And so, therefore, how do you try and deal that? But I think everybody is acutely aware, and back to your question, how much time do you spend on this? You know, a lot is the short answer. But sometimes there are constrictions and limitations that make it more difficult to sort of do it. And one point that I didn't want to forget while you were just talking, Charles, about Hawkeye, we're getting a little bit into sponsorship. But I mean, you know, when I was at Wimbledon, I was the one who went to Rolex and said, here's Hawkeye coming up. Would you like to sponsor it? And of course, the great beauty of Hawkeye and tennis, and I think this is true generally, as I said to Rolex at the time, I said, this is the one time I guarantee you will have every eyeball on television watching the outcome. And if you've got Rolex top left corner or wherever it was, you know, you are going to get a focus of attention and a name recognition that works. So there to me was the classic example of introduction of new technology, which was a huge positive, I think, for the sport and for the content, but also turned into something that obviously had a cost to introduce, but then was you know, a clear, great example of a sponsor wanting to get involved in it.
Ian, there's a question I want to ask you. It's an enormous question. I don't know how you're going to answer it, but I'm desperate to get a perspective from a fan's point of view as to organising something like a Rugby World Cup. Where do you start? You know, you start with a blank sheet of paper. I guess you've got previous World Cups that you can fall back on. But how do you go about sitting down and organising something as enormous as a Rugby World Cup?
Yeah, well, again, it's like it back to the original point about you recruit a bunch of people who hopefully, you know what they're doing. And I think we were lucky in that we had a load of people who worked on the 2012 Olympics. So so we had people who'd got an experience of that. I'll give you an example as well. We wanted to recruit, back to the whole fan experience, a load of volunteers to come and work and, you know, use big fingers and shout at people and welcome them and all that sort of stuff. And we used the same team who'd done the volunteer base for the Olympics. So the good thing is you find a balance of here's a bunch of people who've done this before and know what they're doing. And funnily enough, now around the world, there's almost a bunch of them who move from doing events. I think there's probably even a chunk of people who worked on the 2019 Rugby World Cup in Japan who worked with 2015, who then also, you know, have worked before. But I think the most important thing, going back to there's the usual double whammy on sporting events in that you want the fan experience. The other thing was, I speak with feeling, we needed to sell, because the economics never far away, we had to sell for 2015 250 million quids worth of tickets to break even. So the rugby union and the way it had worked had put in a guarantee for ticket sales, and we had to sell 250 million quids worth of tickets in order to underwrite, you know, the guarantee to World Rugby, the costs, et cetera, et cetera. Now, fortunately, because again, there was a demand, and I think this country loves events, we sold more than that. I have to say, it wasn't quite that when we sat in the early planning meetings. We were more than a little worried. But you have to sort of go back to it. Think very carefully about the practicalities. I mean, we closed the main road outside Twickenham, which was, I think, the first and probably the only time it'll ever happen, in order to help with the transport situation. You spend most of your life terrified about transport, security, you know, provision of toilets, all of those sort of things, as well as actually making sure it's pleasurable. Because if somebody can't get there or they can't go to the loo, they're not going to have a good time, sort of thing. So all of those things bring it together. But it's a mammoth operation and just needs a lot of good planning. That's the other secret, I think.
Coming back to what we call this segment of the show, the sponsor question, which is from Smart Sports. Talking about rugby, and of course one of the big challenges for rugby going forward is how it manages to keep the Southern Hemisphere still in the game. Is there a risk that the summer Southern Hemisphere becomes basically just a breeding ground for the rich North and the clubs?
I think that's a concern. The balance of economics between the North and the South, and I mean, this is obviously crystallized more by, for example, CVC investment into the Premiership, and perhaps even into the Six Nations, will be a concern. And of course, partially, it's also the sort of size of the countries. I mean, if you know, everybody loves going to New Zealand, but what is it, 4 million population? The size is the size, and therefore, how do you maintain all of that? And so, I think a balance of economics and a balance of how that works. And again, they currently have rules and regulations, certainly in New Zealand, to a lesser extent now in Australia and South Africa, about maintaining players. I mean, even in England, you know, the RFU has a rule that says, you know, clubs are paid for English qualified players, and also players will not be selected for the England squad if they go and play outside the country. So I suppose you could say, well, economically, we can afford to do that. So I think it is the classic, how far do you always have to have somebody to play for? I mean, you know, going back to that balance of economics, you've still got to say, even if you looked at the last World Cup, even though I'm sure, you know, friends in New Zealand would be disappointed in their performance, you know, South Africa still won it. You know, New Zealand still got to the semi-final. I'm pretty sure that they will put schemes in place in order to protect that performance. So I don't see yet a particular drop off in Southern Hemisphere performance as a result of that. But I think the economics will undoubtedly put pressure on that, and I suppose they're going to then think about how do we protect our own situation. I mean, I've always been a bit of a believer is. You know, I get the importance of World Rugby running these sort of things. You know, my view, certainly when I was the English RFU, if you like, the English chief executive, was, you know, my primary responsibility is to do what's best for England. You look at the game as a whole as well, but you start on that basis. And therefore, you know, one time I think I suggested to New Zealand when they wanted a revenue share of Twickenham that perhaps they could build their own stadium, which I think was slightly misinterpreted. But that was because the economic share was such that, you know, New Zealand got, as did the other Sanzar nations, income from the Lions Tour, got elements of payment from World Rugby as well. And therefore, you know, we'd invested hundreds of millions into Twickenham as a stadium. So like any business, if you invest the capital, you get the revenue return, but you take that risk and do it. But I think it's a fascinating question. And I think at the moment, I still think the Southern Hemisphere strength of playing. I mean, you look at the South African team. I mean, I did a fantastic job. And again, in the usual fashion, I think 2 years ago, probably they weren't the favourites for the event, but they still came on and won it. So well done to them.
One of the questions that is obviously still reverberating around the world of rugby is we've seen what's happening at Saracens, and not necessarily to go deep into Saracens, but just in general, do you think that there's still a little bit of sort of sorting out of the sorting hat for Harry Potter fans, of just everything settling down in terms of where the riches are, player wages, cap, etc., etc.? Because clearly Saracens have attracted one of the most astonishing squads over many years and done very, very well. And it seems to have been quite a sort of a wobble within the game. What do you feel, crystal balling it, do you feel that this is going to iron out, settle down?
I think it should do, and I suppose for two reasons. I think that, first of all, I think I think it is extremely helpful, and I think the clubs see this, to keep the salary cap. And in principle, we agree with the salary cap, and that's what the tribunal found as well. So I think the important point is, first, we agree we should have a salary cap, and that's sustained. And the second thing is that there was an abiding of a process that was set up with an independent tribunal looking at it all, who came to a conclusion. And therefore, you know, that process was sustained and maintained, and I think you know, that was important as well. So I think on those two points, the former being the most important, probably, is that in order to maintain the economic sustainability and the competitiveness of the league, it's a good idea to have a salary cap. And I think that is maintained and sustained. And that's very important, I think, going forward. So I think that's the most important issue. And I mean, you wouldn't expect me to say a lot. I mean, I'm too intimately involved and it's too current to say very much about this. So that's probably about on the salary cap as far as I'd like to go, really.
No, sure. But Ian, how do you deal as administrators of a game? How do you deal with the quote unquote problem that big money brings? Because, finally rugby is starting to get the money it needs poured at it, because it's become really quite a well-run and an enjoyable spectacle, even for the neutral fan. But you guys must be sitting back there and realise that this Saracens thing is potentially the tip of an iceberg of problems that big money brings to a game that has such a strong amateur tradition. How do you go about kind of trying to put things in place to mitigate that as a problem?
Yeah, I think in some ways it's a nice problem to have. I mean, I think to me the most interesting thing about CVC's investment in Premiership Rugby is here is an external group of high-powered financial guys who think that rugby is worth investing in, and thinks in particular that Premiership Rugby was worth investing in. So that's a positive. And see it also as something that is going to grow. So that is also a positive. So I think that, as I say, I simply look at it that way. The classic danger is, do you then change the values of the sport? Do the players change? Do the supporters change? Does something shift about it? Because it comes, how far are the values different, say, between rugby and football? Is that right, wrong? Is that just because of money? Is it other things? But I think on balance, most people, for a whole variety of reasons, want more money to come into the game because it enables you to do a lot more. And it's probably not a good idea to get me going on the importance of participation for kids. But certainly when I was at the RFU, I mean, I always used to read these things that somebody would say, the money-grasping RFU. And I was thinking, well, what do you think we do with the money? All the RFU would do with money that came in from sponsorship or sales at Twickenham was to invest it back into the game. So every time you landed a sponsorship deal, you were really looking at, for example, well, how many community rugby coaches does that bring in? How many kids sessions can I run at various clubs or help to run? So I think inevitably you want more money, especially if you're in a body that wants to grow participation, and you can only do that participation if you invest proper money in. So I always slightly get amused at people who sort of somehow think that participation happens because you wave a magic wand and it's a good idea. No, it only happens if you put in place a proper plan and invest potentially millions of pounds in it to make it sort of work. So it's a bit like sometimes with the media. I mean, the irony of certainly one of my challenges in various roles has always been, how do you deal with the media and what happens? But you've got to constantly say to yourself, you want the media coverage. You want people to read about your sport. Doesn't mean everybody has the same opinion as you. So I think it's like both of these things. You need to have more money in order to develop it. That's a positive thing. What you do with the money, how you then manage it, what impact it has on the values, you've got to try and tread fairly carefully. But I think it's essential. And by and large, the short answer is, you'd rather have it than not have it.
Absolutely.
And that's a better problem to have because you don't go anywhere if you haven't got. I mean, again, probably a bad example, but I remember after the Olympics, I think it was handball, was saying how wonderfully successful it was, and hordes of children were turning up wanting to play handball, and because they didn't have the money, they didn't even have enough balls, never mind coaching staff. I used to turn up, if I may, I'll give them a check because it was a vivid memory for me. I remember turning up at Dorking Rugby Club when I first started at the RFU. And on a Sunday morning, they would have 900 children there playing rugby. And I thought, wow, how fantastic is this? But in order to do that, you know, they had to have 100 volunteers. They had boys and girls, fantastic as well. You then had to build separate changing rooms, separate toilets. So they needed all the money in order to do that. So all of these things, as I say, revolve around it. So when you're getting sponsorship, and indeed, as you would know, I mean, most sponsors nowadays, I think as well, want that community activation, that participation as part of it. They don't just want a, can I just give you a check for using my name sort of thing. It's much more complex than that.
Well, sorry, long answer. No. It's great, and I think it's the perfect place to wrap up. You know, the importance for the fan. And I with my fan hat firmly in place, it's great to hear someone with your kind of tenure in the administrative side of sport talking about how important that money is to grow sport. Because I think it's very easy to sit and read the papers and fixate on the amount of money Premiership footballers are getting paid, for example. And not really think that the money that the TV rights bring in is actually going to the grassroots. And I think certainly in rugby, to have 900 kids at Dorking is that's extraordinary. I don't think you could fit 900 kids into Dorking. But look, Ian, we've kind of run out of time, sadly. I mean, hopefully you've enjoyed this as much as we have, and hopefully you'll get to enjoy your dessert now, even if it's a little cold. But look, thank you so much for taking the time to join us the week before Christmas. Is there any way that the listeners can follow you, or Twitter handles, or any of that kind of nonsense that you have?
No, far too high tech for me, I'm afraid. And it's been great fun. It's now time, usually, for now I'm retired, of course, my afternoon nap. So I'm most grateful for you calling a halt to it.
You can take your nap.
Everybody's favourite subject, I think.
So take your nap, safe in the knowledge of a job. Very, very well done. Thank you
absolutely
so much. And
a real pleasure.
And have a very Merry Christmas.
Thank you. And Merry Christmas, Ian.
As well. Thanks very much. All the best. Cheers. Bye.
All the best.
Now, gents, I have to ask a question to you two. Is there a more pointless position or role in sport than the goalkeeper on a handball team?
I knew you were going to say that.
Has anybody ever seen a handball goalkeeper save a shot? Ever?
I've never thought of it. Are they allowed to use their hands, or I thought they could only use their legs because the others all use their hands.
No, you basically do jumping jacks. Right? When anyone comes near the door, you do a star jump and you hope the ball hits you. I've never seen any handball goalkeeper save a shot ever. Completely.
It hasn't
pointless.
Ever really taken off in the United Kingdom anyway, has
Funny
it?
Funny that. Hey ho. Well, That was fabulous, Charles. My problem is I love this stuff as a fan. I'm curious about the game. I'm curious about people's insights into the sporting world, and I could sit and talk to people all day long.
What's so interesting about Ian in particular? And I've worked with him a lot over the years, so I have a particular insight. Is that what the questions you were asking is, you know, there's a lot of money in sport, and do the people that run sport know how expensive tickets may be or whatever it may be? And someone like Ian, and actually happily a lot of sports administrators who are getting more and more professional over the years, is they're the ones who understand their duty to the fan, their duty to grow the game, their duty to participation. And listening to Ian talking about whether it be Dorking Rugby Club and 900 youngsters, but just knowing what the RFU, in particular knowing what the All England do to help try and grow the game, is often it's quite well hidden in terms of they're not doing it for self-aggrandizement, but my goodness, is that big schemes that go on. And I think I think for fans listening out there, people should feel comforted that with people like Ian Ritchie around, that sports can be, not all of them, but can be in very, very good hands.
Yeah, look, I echo that. And it's fascinating, isn't it, when you talk to someone, that's why I love talking about the people's connection to sports as a kid. And you can tell that Ian's a passionate sports guy first, and he just happens to be an extraordinarily capable executive second. And that's the way it should be, in my view.
Well, and it's interesting that, Grant, because I think as sport becomes more and more of a multi-billion dollar industry, which it is, and it is growing, is that what you're going to see is more and more very talented executives from outside sport coming in to help continue the monetization for the good and growth of sport, which means that you need to have people who have got passion and an understanding for sport, because if you don't, then you miss the point of what the fan is. You miss the point of why having a good, you know, whether it's good toilets, I mean, from all levels of it, from a good tech experience, all of those things. And it's interesting to me that the All England, which maybe some people think as a sort of bastion of Little England or of a Great Britain of a bygone era, actually, knowing that club as well as I've been privileged to sort of see it behind the scenes, is that they run it as well as any sporting event anywhere in the world, because they're thinking about the fan all of the time.
Well, I think that's the problem. I mean, sports is completely, it just doesn't sit with business as a pure standalone. You know, if you come in as an executive, you can see many executives make a successful transition from one industry to another by applying, you know, their business handbook and doing the same things they did to make a business successful. But I think, like you say, I dread people bringing in just capable executives who don't have any understanding of sport and the fan, and just look at sport as a business, look at the numbers, and don't understand how important that emotional connection is. Because I think without that, the whole thing just sinks.
Yeah, that's right. You couldn't support a football club or a rugby club or a cricket, county cricket club or whatever, if you were only applying business criteria and profitability. That would not understand even that sense of being a true fan means tolerating abject defeat for often seasons at a time, but your loyalty never being put it under threat. And so it isn't the traditional model. And I think going forward that the best business leaders in sport will be very, very talented business leaders with an uncommon touch of pure, true fan within their DNA. I think that's the golden bullet for sport.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Well, look, we've run out of time, sadly, Giles. We've also lost Roger, thanks to storms.
No, I'm here.
Oh, yeah,
I'm
yeah. Oh, we thought we lost you. You're back. We thought we lost you.
I was listening away.
That is the longest I've ever heard you go without speaking.
Miss you, Rog. Miss you.
Yeah, listen, I was enjoying that. But the thing that I would say, because I am obviously...
Spartacus?
The criteria of being... the business guy that understands sport is probably, you know, where I came from. And I think it's going to be even more necessary going forward. You know, when we talk about the fan, the point I would make is that there's no one fan anymore. You know, Formula One have probably got into 7 or 8 different categories. And, you know, and even without going that deep, you can say that the Gen Z fan and the 50-year-old with his 38-year-old son at Plymouth are two different beasts, as is the hospitality guy. So the trick isn't just to say, let's always remember the fan and business doesn't sit with it. The trick is to say, who is the fan and how do we need to segment our offering for every single category that they have?
Yeah, no, it's a valid point. Although, and let's face it, Christmas is the time for segmentation, even if it's only with a Terry's chocolate orange.
Oh my God, that is the worst.
Other chocolates are available. Other chocolates are available.
Are you going to do the advent calendar thing?
Well, I genuinely feel bad. The only thing I forgot to do was to apologise to Ian for Fulham taking 3 points off Leeds this coming weekend. So, Giles, if you do see him again, perhaps you could just pass on my condolences.
I certainly will.
All right, gents. Well, look, and we've come to the end of another week. Technical difficulties notwithstanding. I thoroughly enjoyed every minute of that, but... please, if you're listening out there at home, do share the podcast with your friends. Rate and review us on iTunes. That helps more than you would possibly imagine, funnily enough. In the meantime, we'll be back next week. Please follow us on Twitter. You'll find us at EntertainedR, that's A-R-E the word. You'll find me on Twitter at TTMYGH.
And you'll find me at GilesMorgan71, the captain's table.
I just want to say... definitely not happy holidays, because that's not the kind of guy I am. So if you're Jewish, happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, and if you don't believe in anything, get drunk. And if you want to follow me,
what?
RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Gentlemen, as always, a real pleasure. Talk to you soon.